My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/MPN to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/MPN. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You are listening to the On Business Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Lieberman, lawyer for entrepreneurs, founder of Hashtag Legal, and your go-to resource for all things legal and business strategy. In my 16 years of practicing law, my clients have come to me with some of the most unexpected questions. You would not believe some of the things that I hear. In this podcast, I will identify and explain the issues in your business where legal and business strategy intersect using real-world experiences and interviews with leading experts. You will get a behind-the-scenes sneak peek into the real-life successes and failures of business owners with my analysis of the things we did right and the things we could do better. So sit back and relax and get ready to learn in the most un-business way possible. Welcome to episode 9, season 2 of the On Business Podcast. I cannot believe how far along into the podcast this season we are, and we have another amazing interview for you today. This interview is all about international negotiations, which I think is so interesting because really we focused on negotiating in other countries or negotiating with individuals who maybe don't have the same background as you or come from a different culture and negotiating across different types of disciplines. So I think this applies, although, you know, you may not be doing any international negotiations, but this does apply right here because the people that we deal with and talk to, we all come from different places. And sometimes, as we've talked about in previous episodes, where we come from in a negotiation and how we negotiate may be a product of our background and our culture. And it's important to understand that as part of the research that we're doing. So I have a wonderful guest today who can talk all about that. She has a wealth of experience. Sese Tetebe Godu is the founder and CEO of Tandem Consulting Group, providing strategy and organizational development consulting, coaching, and training to clients across 3 continents. She is currently a venture partner at Republic, a coach at The Grand, faculty at Glasgow Caledonian New York College, and a Phillips Exeter Academy General Alumni Association director. She is so busy. She's formerly the first COO of Future Now, the States Project, and the founding COO of Run for Something. Sese is a McGill and Columbia grad. She's also a member of Nationswell, Dreamers and Doers, Chief Smash Squad, and Asian Boss Ladies. This is an awesome interview, and I'm excited for you to hear all about Sese's experiences. I think you're going to learn so much.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure,
I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/MPN to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/MPN. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Say, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Jamie. It's such a pleasure to be here.
I'm so thrilled that you are able to make it on. Please tell everyone in our audience who you are and what it is that you do.
My name is Sese Tetevegadu. I am the founder and CEO of Tandem Consulting Group. We offer strategy and organizational development consulting, training, executive coaching. But in the work that I do a lot of negotiation training for folks, a lot of facilitation. So I'm in a lot of rooms where negotiation is happening.
Yes. When we were connected, I was so excited because I felt like you brought a definitely interesting perspective for sure. And that's one of the things I love so much about negotiation is it's different for everybody. So I'd love to kick off and I'd love to start with asking you, just generally speaking, how do you approach negotiation?
I want to take a second, you know, not to get too pedantic about it. Would love to kind of even unpack that question a little bit, right? Because I think that a lot of people think of negotiation as this like discrete encapsulated activity. Logically, tactically, that can absolutely be the case. We talk about walking up to a negotiation table for a reason. We talk about a place where negotiation happens. But my view is that we are negotiating all the time. Every day, every minute. So we're negotiating our salaries. We're negotiating what to watch on TV with our partners. We're negotiating what our kids can eat. And so we're negotiating constantly. And I think that if I were to consider kind of the way that I approach, I would talk about Roger Fisher's Getting to Yes framework, something that is simple, that is the cornerstone of most negotiation and mediation work, where we talk about things like positions. Positions are your child saying, I'm hungry. I want a cookie. And you saying, no, you have to go to bed, right? Those are two, I'm hungry and I want a cookie and you have to go to bed are two positions. And then we think about things like interests. So what are the interests underlying that? Your child's hungry. Maybe your child just doesn't want to go to bed yet. And you as a parent, your interest is in getting a little bit of time in the evening without having to take care of your kids every second of the day. Once we understand interests, we can get into options. We can start really understanding what those options look like. And then I think the thing that a lot of people miss is BATNA. And Jamie, I know that you as a negotiation professional have probably heard a lot about BATNA. But just to remind your listeners, BATNA is your best alternative to a negotiated agreement. It is the thing that lets you know whether you should accept the deal that is being offered to you. Not knowing your BATNA is the main way in which people get emotionally hijacked in a negotiation. It's the main reason why people accept deals that are not actually good for them. Knowing your BATNA and the other party's BATNA, a successful negotiation isn't just about your side. It is understanding the other side, anticipating the other side as much as you possibly can. That is as important to achieving success in the negotiation as knowing what it is that you want and what your alternatives look like. So when I think about approach, I go back to fundamentals, first principles, the things that work and have been proven to work over and over and over again.
I think that's great. I mean, what you're describing to me and what I hear from so many people is just, it needs to be collaborative. We can't just be working in our silo. And I love your kid example because I actually have two children myself and I talk about negotiating with my kids all the time. They are the greatest negotiators. I wish I could channel their skills sometimes in my day-to-day work. But I think that it's really important because it's not just about, particularly as a parent, you often think to yourself like, well, what I say goes, right? But you have to take into account, like, what are their needs? What are they looking for? What is it that they actually want? Are they hungry, like you said, or do they just not want to go to bed, or what's going on here? But that translates so beautifully into a negotiation that's very collaborative, where you're actually wanting to learn about the other party and what it is that they truly want.
Right. Kids are excellent positional negotiators. I think they come out of the womb knowing how to negotiate and basically do what we would call positional bargaining. Exactly. And I think to get to that collaborative moment with them, you actually have to model and teach them how to do that. We don't, unfortunately, I think, walk around knowing how to do this stuff naturally. I think that's why, you know, the work of people like Roger Fisher was so important in terms of teaching us to do things like separating people from the problem. Your kids aren't the problem.
Right.
You're trying to bring them to the same side of the table as you so that you can look at the problem together, solve it together. Another concept, going to the balcony. When you're feeling emotional about something, really trying to step back from that, observing your own behavior and your own words and actions, almost as a third party, looking down on what's happening rather than being so close to it that you're super reactive. Kids are a great example.
I like that second point that you've made about, I have not actually heard the term going to the balcony. So that was really interesting. But I like the idea of taking the emotion out of it and being able to step back and say, you know, what am I feeling? What am I thinking? Why am I reacting in this way? And how can I bring myself back in order to be more effective in collaborative negotiation? I think that's great. And I like that term. That's a good one. Mentioned BATNA, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. I'm so thrilled that you brought that up because I think so many people get so locked in negotiations as to like, this is where it needs to go. And they often lose sight that there could be like 10 or other ways that this could turn out actually really great. But also along the lines of that is the walkaway position. So not only having your best alternative to the negotiated agreement, but also knowing those moments where you have to just say no, like this is my boundary. So how do you handle that, those really hard conversations, either in your work or with clients, when you know you're at a point where you're like, yeah, this just isn't going to go where it needs to go?
I love that question, Jamie. In fact, because I've had to deploy that a few times over the course of my career. And I think those moments came when I learned to truly value myself, my time. There was a lot of respect and self-boundary work that needed to happen before I could get to the point where I was willing to say no, right? I think as women in particular, we are nurtured to just say yes, 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 yes all the time. And it takes a lot of work, a lot of self-work to get to that point where we're willing to say no. When I've said no, I try to do it with as much compassion as possible for where the other person is coming from. I was recently listening to a meditation podcast. I'm also a mediator, also a meditator.
I love it.
Yeah. But I was listening to a meditation podcast recently where the meditator shared something that her teacher had said to her years ago, which is that if you are feeling offended, you are choosing to feel offended. There's this moment when you can actually look at what the other person is doing or saying and acknowledge, this feels like a boundary violation. This feels like something that I'm just not willing to do. And you can also choose to see that moment as state of the union, a status report on where that person is on their personal journey, where they are emotionally, where they are with their stress, where they are with their consciousness and self-awareness, and less about you.
Yes.
And I think the moment that you see that it's less about you and more about them is the moment that you can come in with more compassion. And so when I say no, I say it compassionately, and they don't need all the details. I think that's another thing that women...
Yeah,
I think that's another thing that women do. So I have a friend who is telling me about a client that she was working with where they were really struggling because the men were coming in and saying to their admin staff, the men were coming in and saying, hey, you know, I can't make this meeting. Can you clear the meetings today? And that was it. And the women were coming in when they had something going on and they were saying, hi, so my kid's sick. I have to pick them up from school. Can you clear the rest of the day? And I don't want to say that we should behave more like men because screw that. Yes. But I do want to say, like, there's no need for women to overshare the way that we've been taught to overshare. Let people fill in the blanks for you. When I say no, I give them just enough. I say, hey, unfortunately, my schedule has shifted. something has come up personally or professionally, I'm not going to be able to do this for you. So I'm going to need to change the nature of our agreement or change the nature of our relationship in some way. And that's how I deal with it. We don't need to get into the details. We don't need to litigate the emotional push and pull of what happened. We don't need to go into the history. It doesn't do anyone any good for us to do that with each other.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's also the I'm sorry that comes after mm-hmm. the no. I'm really sorry, but I can't. No, just no. That's okay. Just
yeah. No is a complete sentence, yes. Right? And women forget that all the time. And trust me, as a Japanese American woman, I'm sorry is language that is at the tip of my tongue all the time, right? So I've had to really train myself to not, you know, and I personally don't think that there's anything wrong with saying I'm sorry. I think it can be a generous gesture, but it has to be a choice. It has to be something that you're choosing to do, not simply a reaction to something that society is expecting of you in that moment.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I find that when I'm coaching clients, particularly my female clients, like you mentioned, their emails tend to be like blocks of text or, you know, and I'm just like, you don't need any of this. There's two sentences in here that are relevant. The rest of it doesn't matter. So there's value to that editing and really just saying what needs to be said. Because you don't have, like you said, we don't have to give a reason. It doesn't matter if it's personal. It doesn't matter if it's professional. If you can't make it, you can't make it.
Yeah. And, you know, I've managed to walk away from things without burning bridges because that, you know, because why? If we just survived 2 years of one of the worst pandemics that ever hit the planet, right? If you're still alive, congratulations. We're surviving the economy, you know, about to go into a bear market. We're surviving climate change. Like there's so much at stake. There's so much happening to us right now. Do yourself a favor and don't add more emotional stress when you don't need to.
Agreed. I think that's wonderful advice. One that probably comes over time, right? So when you were starting, a lot of lessons. So when you were starting, how has that approach changed over time when you look at negotiation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, in my earlier days, I wasn't as, to go back to BATNA, for example, right? Knowing your BATNA really requires a lot of self-awareness. It requires you to know what your values are. What do you care about? What are you willing to compromise on and not compromise on? What are those red lines for you? I think with experience, with age, frankly, I think comes a lot more wisdom when it comes to those kinds of things. And I would say, you know, pattern recognition when I'm negotiating, mediating, training, facilitating, you just see some patterns over and over and over again. And those become, you know, you don't ever want to put people in a bucket to the extent that you're not able to respond effectively, but patterns emerge. You know, I think pattern recognition allows you to respond in just a more skillful way in the moment.
Yeah. It's practice.
It's practice.
It's practice. I say it all the time about so many things and I laugh about it because, you know, even just in terms of like the legal world, what we do is called a practice. And so because that's what we're doing, we're practicing. And so there's value to practice. There's value to experience. And that changes over time. It allows you to see, like you said, patterns, but you start to say, oh, I know where this is going. I mean, you just know, right? You get the email and you can read the subtext. You understand where things, and so that allows, I think when you have the experience, when you are practicing, it allows you to be able to shift in a way that takes time. And that's why I think like negotiation strategies change because you start to realize I'm comfortable with this language. I'm not comfortable with this language. Here are my boundaries. Here's something that I'll deal with. And that's different for every person. I think that that's really important to recognize and why practice is so important. But I would love to hear from you. What is some of the most difficult negotiation that you've ever dealt with? And maybe you could give a little bit of context and tell us what was so challenging about it.
Before we dive fully into that question, I think maybe a bridge anecdote. When I was being trained actually as a facilitator, one of the most effective exercises I went through was a blind facilitation. And I think you could do this in a negotiation exercise, right? Just to get that practice and and get those muscles working. But the blind facilitation was a situation where you had a room full of people. They chose a topic and then they asked you what your biggest fear was in the facilitation. Mm-hmm. At the time that I was doing this, I was 23 or 24. I had never lived in the Middle East before. I was about to head to the Middle East for the first time. And I said, you know, I'm really worried that as a young Asian American woman, I'm going to get there and I'm going to have a room full of men and they're Muslim men, and they're not going to respect me. They're not going to allow me to do my job. And that's my biggest fear. So you tell the group, you walk out of the room, they strategize on how they're going to trigger you. Oh. And then you come back in, you start facilitating, you know the topic, but you don't know anything else. And you start facilitating. And then at some point in the facilitation, someone does something related to your biggest fear.
Wow.
And you react to it in the moment, right? And you figure out what is happening. And what I loved about it was that, I mean, it was pretty, you know, I'm already sweating because I can remember that moment. I'm just like, woof. I got to the Middle East, and nothing in the Middle East remotely compared to that worst case scenario in the room. I was never disrespected. I was never not paid attention to or not honored or allowed to do my work in the room. But it just gave me a sense of like, if this were to happen, here's how I would respond to it. And as you said, practice is everything. Practice those moments when you think the worst thing is about to happen. And 9 times out of 10, it's not going to happen. And you're just going to be even better prepared for the better things that happen to you. So just wanted to share that.
That's great advice. Yeah.
You know, I think when we talk about practicing, like really make it tough. Don't hold back. But to your original question about kind of the most difficult negotiation, I would say a couple of things, you know, come to mind. One is that I had a client in Sudan, a Swiss-based organization that was working in Sudan, in Darfur specifically. And they asked me to go in and conduct a number of negotiation trainings for their staff. Turns out there is no information on Sudanese pedagogy available outside, you know, in English anyway, maybe it's in Arabic. And so having to construct those negotiation exercises and having to actually train people without knowing how they would respond or react to the material meant a lot of on the fly work to make sure that things were relevant to them. So that's one story that comes to mind. Another is, so very early on in my career, I was responsible for overseeing the strategic planning process for the United Nations in Kenya. And the UN in Kenya is one of the largest UN systems in the world. They have 16, at the time, they had 16 UN agencies headquartered in Nairobi. And so the strategic planning process required all 16 UN agencies to agree on their strategy, on a coherent, cohesive, coordinated strategy at the country level. If you can only imagine, right? Yeah. 16, like we're talking complex multi-party negotiation at this stage where everyone has different culture, agenda, motives, budgets, power dynamics. All of it was in the mix. And so helping them navigate and basically in real time negotiating for them, right? In some aspects, you know, playing facilitator, mediator, negotiator all at once for them to get to the finish line of this comprehensive strategy, which by the way, then had to be signed off on by the government of Kenya.
Oh my gosh.
So there was an additional layer, right?
Yeah.
But it was a fascinating challenge. And I remember there was one moment that I will never forget where, because we have limited time. It's not like, you know, these are UN agencies that are out there trying to save lives, right? We don't have a ton of leisure time here, free time. And I remember an argument broke out over whether they were going to use this letter or that letter in an acronym in the document.
Oh gosh.
And I let them go on, you know, let them get it out of their system for 20, 30 minutes. And then I looked at them and I said, we just spent 30 minutes on a conversation about which word we're going to use in this document. And here are all of the other things that we have to accomplish by the end of this process. Where would you prefer we spend our time? And I think as a negotiator, that's often what you're helping people, yourself, the other party, what you're helping people remember, staying focused on the things that matter, rather than getting distracted, getting hijacked, right, emotionally by the thing that's happening, staying focused on the goal and on the ultimate outcome that you're trying to achieve.
That's great advice. I think we often can get so emotional, like you said, and just locked in on something. And that reminder of like, we just spent 30 minutes on this, you know, we're not even going to remember this in a month. And that's a great reminder. I'm interested because one topic as we're wrapping up, but you mentioned this, is the cultural differences. And I don't think that's a topic that I've necessarily spoken to anybody about in connection with negotiation, because I think the majority of the people that I've spoken to are negotiating in the US with other US-based companies, entities. And so we certainly have a number of cultural differences in the US, which is another podcast for another time. However, I think it's really interesting, and I'd like to hear how, you know, you sort of bridge those gaps or get information that you may need when there are, in many countries or many places, extreme cultural differences that have to be taken into account, because you'll never even understand someone's position or interest at all if you don't understand where they're coming from.
No, it's such a great question, Jamie, and thanks for asking it. I mean, as much research, as much homework as you possibly can, right? Whether that is reading up, you know, if you can find information that's written down, great. If you have to call people in the country and say, hi, you know, talk to me about how people approach this, with the caveat that the person that you're talking to may not be representative of, there may be class differences, right? I think that's one of the challenges. I went to grad school here in the US, a very international, diverse program. But the problem was that the international students who came to the US to study tended to be from the elites in their country. So if you wanted to understand what it was like to be poor in one of those other countries, you couldn't go to one of your classmates and ask that question because they wouldn't know.
Right.
And so, you know, culture is gender, it's age, it's race, it's class. So making sure that when you're doing that homework, that you're also compensating and calibrating for who you're talking to and the lenses that they might be bringing into the room with them as well. And, you know, just a couple of really quick anecdotes. The stories about Japanese negotiations are legend. American businessmen going into Japan thinking, walking out of a negotiation, thinking like, oh, I got the deal, right? Because the Japanese were sitting there and they're like, hai, hai, ah, so desu ka, ah, hai, yes, wakarimashita, right? Yes, yes, I understand. Ah, okay. Thinking that that's a yes. The Japanese really just don't like to say no. They're gonna try to give you 5 million ways of not saying no. But what they're saying is no. They're saying no all the way down the line, but you just don't know that. Being aware of that in the negotiation, right? Being aware of, can I be direct, or is directness actually a sign of disrespect? Do I have to talk to other people before I talk to these people? Because I hate this example, but in the old days, when men thought that women were their property, asking the father's hand for the daughter's hand in marriage before you asked her, right, was a sign of respect. Understanding what those cultural differences look like can really affect the outcome of the negotiation that you're conducting. And my advice is, you better figure it out before you're in the room.
Yes, that's amazing advice. Research. I talk about this all the time. In any negotiation, you should never walk blindly into a room, and you should never walk blindly into a room with assumptions. Many people think their assumptions are research, but they're not. And I think your advice is so spot on. You have to research. You have to ask the questions. You cannot make assumptions about anything. And that also requires not only doing your research ahead of time, but asking questions in the room to make sure that all the assumptions that you've made or the research that you've learned in the most respectful way. But you have to have that, you know, sort of baseline information in order to even know how to ask the right question. I think that's wonderful advice.
Right. And to your point, Jamie, when it comes time for you to assess the options that are on the table, right, that's where third party credible sources really come in handy, that both sides have agreed to. So if you're selling me a car, I'm not taking your cousin mechanic's word that car is worth a certain amount of money. I'm going to go to Blue Book and I'm going to ask you to agree that the Blue Book valuation is the correct valuation, right? Yes. And so that's also part of it, is not just blindly accepting based on assumptions that are being made, but also going to third-party credible sources as well.
Great, great advice. Yes. Like, no Wikipedia, please. It's the same as your cousin mechanic.
Let me edit it right before the negotiation.
Exactly. This makes me laugh so hard when people break things out. You know, you're having a conversation and you can lose credibility that way. Certainly, you know, with somebody that you're, you know, credibility is everything in a negotiation. So I think that's amazing advice. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences, your wisdom. Yeah. I'm so grateful that we were able to have this chat, and I loved learning a bit more about, you know, some of the experiences you had. They're so different than some of the other people that I've spoken to. Can you tell everybody where they can find you?
Sure. So you can find me on LinkedIn. I am really not super active on Twitter, and I anticipate being less active on Twitter in coming months. But LinkedIn is the major place to find me. And you can also find the company at tandemcg.com.
Perfect. I'll drop that link in the show notes. Thank you again for taking the time and sharing your wonderful information with the audience.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jamie. Really such a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for listening. We would love if you would subscribe and review this podcast and like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. If you'd like to get in touch with Jamie, you can email her at info@hashtag-legal.com, all spelled out, or find her on social media on Instagram at #_legal, all spelled out, and YouTube at Jamie Lieberman Rocks. Thanks so much and have an amazing week.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.